It is really a pleasure to be here, especially for a new kid on the block, not actually a new kid on this block, because I've been at the Scripps Research Institute for the past 30 years, but I'm absolutely a newcomer to stem cell research. My laboratory, as Evan said, has been interested in trying to develop therapeutics for several of the neurodegenerative diseases. And just to give you a little bit of an overview of the triplet repeat type of neurodegenerative diseases. These come in several types. In general, these diseases are caused by the expansion of simple trinucleotide sequences. These trinucleotide sequences occur in many different genes. There are approximately 20 different diseases, all caused by triplet repeat expansions in different genes. Hence, they affect different neuronal cell types, causing different types of diseases. But to summarize, many of these diseases are protein misfolding diseases, such as Huntington's disease and many of the spinocerebellar ataxias. These are movement disorders. In general, those diseases are caused by the expansion of the trinucleotide CAG within the coding regions of various genes. CAG encodes the amino acid glutamine, so you get an expansion of a polyglutamine tract. These diseases manifest themselves when the glutamine tract reaches a certain threshold. And in many of these diseases, you see an intergenerational expansion. In other words, these diseases get worse as the affected gene passes from parent to offspring. Okay, see, those are the protein misfolding diseases. There are also messenger RNA aggregate diseases, RNA aggregation diseases. One example of this is myotonic dystrophy type 1, where a CTG repeat is located in the 3' untranslated region of a particular messenger RNA, and you get many, many copies of this CTG repeat in the DNA, which is copied into a CUG in the RNA. And when these repeats get over a certain threshold, you get sequestering of essential RNA splicing factors by the CUG repeat RNA, leading to, in this case, a particular form of muscular dystrophy. Well, the particular disease I'd like to talk about today is a transcription defect disease called Friedreich's ataxia. It's caused by a GAA repeat expansion in an intron of an essential mitochondrial protein gene. This gene is encoded in the nuclear genome and encodes a 21 kilodalton protein called frataxin. This protein is involved in iron sulfur cluster assembly and transport in the mitochondrion, and defects in the levels of this protein, that is, reductions in the level of this protein, cause a severe neurodegenerative phenotype. The predominant cell type that's affected are the large sensory neurons of the dorsal root ganglion. This causes a progressive neurodegeneration. Ultimately, there's also an associated diabetes in about 20 to 30% of the patients. But in most patients, after perhaps 20 years or so, they develop cardiomyopathies, also caused by the accumulation of iron deposits due to the lack in the iron deposits in the heart due to the lack of this protein frataxin. Okay, so since this defect, this GAA repeats, are in an intron, they actually don't change the coding potential of the gene. What these GAA repeats do is they silence the gene. So one therapeutic strategy for this disease, and I should mention there is no effective therapy for this disease, either treating symptoms, the neurological symptoms, or reactivating the gene, but one therapeutic strategy, since the coding potential of the gene isn't changed, would be to reactivate this silenced gene, since these long GAA repeats silence the gene. So one of the things that my lab got interested in a few years ago is, what is the mechanism whereby the GAA repeats induced gene silencing? There were studies in the literature that clearly showed that the presence of these long repeats prevents the progress of RNA polymerase along this gene. So you get transcriptional pausing, you don't get a mature functional mRNA, and hence you get reduced levels of this frataxin protein. But what's the mechanism? There was a lot of data in the literature showing that the GAA repeats adopt an unusual DNA structure. But coming from a chromatin background, this really smelled to me as an epigenetic disease. Okay. So the idea here is, as Evan pointed out, active genes have certain chromatin marks, such as acetylated histones and certain types of methylated histones. Histone deacetylase enzymes, the enzymes that take off the acetyl marks, the active marks off of the tails of the histones, lead you down a progression towards heterochromatin, that is, silence chromatin that is not transcriptionally active. So the activity of histone deacetylases, histone methyltransferases, and recruitment of heterochromatin proteins, which are essentially glue, could possibly silence the gene. One method to assess this hypothesis in Friedreich's ataxia is called chromatin immunoprecipitation, where we use antibodies to these various post-synthetic modification marks on the histone proteins, immunoprecipitate chromatin that's been fragmented and cross-linked, and then do PCR to ask whether the chromatin has active marks or inactive marks. And we use primers that are specific for either the promoter of the frataxin gene or the region immediately upstream or downstream of the GAA repeats. You can't actually look at the repeats themselves because there are numerous GAA repeat sequences in the genome. So you have to look at the flanking sequences. Well, when postdoc in my lab, Liz Sarandi, did this for two cell lines established from a Friedreich's ataxia patient and an unaffected sibling, what she found was that the level of histone acetylation at the promoter didn't really differ too much between the non-affected cell line and the Friedreich's cell line. But what she found when comparing the level of histone acetylation at particular residues at the region immediately upstream or downstream of the GAA repeats were that particular amino acid residues, particular lysine residues in the amino terminal tails of the histones were deacetylated in the affected cell line on the frataxin gene, on this intron in the frataxin gene relative to the unaffected allele, which is highly active in supporting transcription of the frataxin gene. Now, as Evan mentioned, histone methylation can also be a mark for gene silencing. And one particular mark is trimethylation of lysine 9 on histone H3. And so we used an antibody to this particular mark and compared trimethylation in both the affected cell line and the unaffected cell line. And as you can see here, there's massive levels of trimethylation of histone H3, lysine 9, in the affected cell line compared to the unaffected cell line. Lysine 9 trimethylation is the landing site for this protein, heterochromatin protein 1 that I mentioned previously. And so we believe that all of these results are consistent with a model whereby the GAA repeats somehow signal the cell to form silent heterochromatin on this gene. It's all consistent with this model. Now, we don't know the link between how the GAA repeats signal this and the endpoint, but we know that the endpoint is true. Okay, so now that we know that this is a heterochromatin silencing disease, what can we do to reverse silencing? Well, as I mentioned, histone deacetylase enzymes are responsible for taking off the acetate groups. If one were to inhibit those enzymes, you might allow the histone acetyltransferases to put back on acetate groups and render the silent frataxin gene active again. So there are a number of chemical entities that are known to act as histone deacetylase inhibitors. So a postdoc in my lab, David Herman, just bought a collection of HDAC inhibitors, histone deacetylase, abbreviated HDAC inhibitors. They come in many different chemical flavors. And what David found was that most of the highly active HDAC inhibitors, such as SAHA, which is in clinical trials for a variety of cancers, MS-275, valproic acid, a number of common HDAC inhibitors, they were all inactive. They didn't reactivate the silent frataxin gene in that Friedreich cell line. But this molecule called BML-210, commercially available from a company called BioMol in Pennsylvania, had a little bit of activity. Okay, since my lab does a little bit of chemistry, we decided to take this molecule and do standard med chem on it. And this is the result from a number of postdoc man-years of chemical synthesis, both in my lab and in a company that has licensed these molecules. Basically, we know that changing this linker length to 5-methylenes is optimum. We need this orthoamino group for chelation of a zinc atom in the active site of the HDAC enzyme. We know that increasing hydrophobicity over here improves activity. But anyway, that molecule turned out to be highly active. And just to show you this and to compare the activity of our molecules versus another HDAC inhibitor, SAHA, here's a Western blot showing total histone H3, acetylated histone H3 after treatment with one of our compounds and then washout. You see long-lived acetylation. You see high levels of frataxin protein coming up. So here's the level of frataxin protein in the untreated cell line and then after treatment with our HDAC inhibitor. It works. Here's a similar experiment with SAHA. SAHA is an active HDAC inhibitor, but it's a rapid on, rapid off inhibitor, and we don't see increases in frataxin in the way we do with our compounds. Okay, so these are cell lines. What about primary cells from Friedreich's patients? We've been very fortunate collaborating with a neurologist at UCLA, Sue Perlman, who's provided us blood samples from a large number of Friedreich's patients. We isolate primary lymphocytes from these patients and test them in vitro with our compounds. And in every instance, we can see correction of the transcription defect in primary lymphocytes, okay, with our class of compounds. We don't see this with the other commercially available compounds. This is unique to our class of compounds. We've worked out the target and the mechanism of action, and we see that our compounds specifically target one histone deacetylase enzyme, HDAC3, and they have a unique mode of action. They're slow-on, slow-off inhibitors, and we believe that's the reason why they are active and other HDAC inhibitors are not. Okay. But anyway, the experiments that I've told you about so far have all been done in either established cell lines or lymphoid cells from patients, not in the brain. And obviously, this is a neurological disease. So we called up a fellow by the name of Massimo Pandolfo in Brussels, Belgium, who has a mouse model for the disease. He has a knock-in mouse that has GAA repeats inserted in the first intron of the mouse frataxin gene. And that mouse has lower levels of frataxin, mRNA. And when we treat that mouse with our compounds, we see massive histone acetylation in the mouse brain, showing that the compound crosses the blood-brain barrier and is active in the mouse brain. And we restore transcription to the relatively silenced frataxin gene. Okay, all of this is good. So with these results in hand, the Scripps Research Institute licensed these compounds for development to a company in Boston called Repligen Corporation. They looked at the pharmacological properties of the compounds and decided they needed to improve on them. So what they did is they generated a library of about 200 derivatives, shipped the active HDAC inhibitors out to us. We tested them again in lymphocytes, and we found some real winners. And I'm just going to point out one called 109. So that molecule differs from our lead molecule in just a trivial way, but it's better in terms of penetration of the blood-brain barrier, and activity in restoring frataxin. But all of these experiments so far have been done, again, in lymphocytes. What about human neuronal cells? So that's why I'm here. So obviously, we have taken the standard approach, the 4-transcription factor retroviral transduction approach, to take Friedreich's ataxia patient fibroblasts and turn them into iPS cells with the aim of differentiating these cells into neurons in the hope that we can use those neurons both to study the molecular basis for the gene silencing the disease, the defects in mitochondrial metabolism in the Friedreich's neuronal cells, and compound screening. So Sherman Koo, a graduate student in the lab, with the help of the iPS community here, Gene Loring and many others, have developed several different iPS lines from Friedreich's primary fibroblasts. We used standard immunofluorescence methods to show that our compound, that The iPS cells really have the hallmarks of pluripotency, both at the level of immunofluorescent markers for stage-specific antigens, and also at the mRNA levels for various genes that are highly expressed in pluripotent cells versus the parent fibroblasts. But most importantly, Sherman showed that the iPS cell lines retain silencing of the frataxin gene. So here's comparing a normal human ES cell line set to 100%, the parent fibroblasts having about 25% of wild-type frataxin mRNA, and the iPS cells also having about 20% normal levels of frataxin mRNA. Now, what about the GAA repeats? Here's where it gets interesting. Turns out that on generation of the iPS cells, you see expansion of the GAA repeats, just as in the human disease. As I mentioned, in these triplet repeat diseases, between generations, you see expansion. Well, on generation of the iPS cells, from here are the two alleles in the fibroblasts, they expand in different iPS clones. These clones were from fibroblasts from one individual, and here's a single clone from fibroblasts from a second individual. This is unique to the frataxin gene in Friedreich's patients, because when we take iPS cells from fibroblasts from a patient with spinal muscular atrophy that has a normal frataxin gene, we don't see such expansion. When we look at other regions of the genome that have GAA repeats in the Friedreich's iPS cells, we also don't see expansion. So we asked whether this expansion would continue to occur on propagation of the cells, and indeed it does. Here's the parent fibroblasts. These are PCR products on an agarose gel, the two alleles. The iPS clones, one particular iPS clone from these fibroblasts, and then after 15 passages, you see even further expansion. There's a lot of data in the literature on the role of DNA repair enzymes in this expansion process in various neurological diseases such as Huntington's disease, Fragile X, and myotonic dystrophy. How am I doing time-wise, Evan? Okay, getting close. So Sherman looked for the expression of the genes that have been implicated in trinucleotide repeat instability in Huntington's disease and the like. And of these, the DNA mismatch repair enzymes, MSH2 and MSH3, have been implicated in repeat instability in Huntington's disease and myotonic dystrophy. And what Sherman found was at the mRNA level, both authentic ES cells and tube iPS cell lines have increased levels of MSH2 mRNA compared to the parent fibroblasts. And you can really see this at the protein level. So here's the level of MSH2 protein in the parent fibroblasts, massive increases in this particular DNA repair enzyme that's been implicated both biochemically and genetically in repeat expansion in Huntington's disease. We also see this in a generation of the iPS cell line in these Friedreich's fibroblasts. Okay, so Sherman is currently doing shRNA knockdown of MSH2 to really implicate this as a mechanism for repeat instability on generation of the pluripotent cells. But the last thing I'd like to talk about in one last minute is differentiation of these iPS cells into neurons for compound screening. So we used one of the standard methods. This was one that was published by Marella Dottori just last year, taking iPS cells using noggin induction to go to neurospheres and then replating to form neurons. And you can see beta-3 tubulin staining, as we saw in Larry Goldstein's talk, as a marker for neuronal induction. Will these cells, or immature neurons, actually respond to the HDAC inhibitors in the way that they do in lymphoid cells? The answer is yes. Recall I mentioned that this compound 109 was highly active in restoring frataxin levels in lymphocytes. It's also highly active in the same assay in neuronal precursor cells. So this, the availability of these neuronal cells derived from the iPS cells will allow us to get at the mechanisms of gene silencing in the disease, hopefully an insight into pathogenesis in the disease and allow us to continue on compound screening for this and other related neurodegenerative diseases. So this work was done by these individuals in my lab here. The mouse studies were done in collaboration with Massimo Pandolfo's lab in Brussels. Many compounds came from Repligen Corporation. A number of microarray experiments that I didn't have a chance to talk about were done at UCLA, and I thank all of these institutions for their financial support. Thanks very much.
We have time for a few questions.
Okay. Would you like me to do this?
Do you think the epigenomics is going to also manifest itself in things like intron stability, given you have your triplet repeat expansion? Does that start altering the ultimate splicing pattern?
We've looked at that. The fact that we get increases in the level of the protein suggests that splicing is not affected by the presence of the large GAA repeats in the primary transcript. There was actually a paper early on in the field, back in about 98, that actually looked at splicing, and they concluded that there was no splicing defect in this disease.
More questions?
Yeah. I have a question about the specificity over here.
Okay.
I don't know where I'm looking.
Oh, here. Hi. So where the specificity is coming from, do you think that inhibitor affect only one gene, or it's possible a group of genes?
Specificity. Selectivity of the compound,
right,
or its effect on total genomic transcription.
Exactly. I assume that
both? Okay. So
will affect many genes in a genome.
Oh, yes. So we've done a large number of microarray experiments, and we see upregulation and downregulation of hundreds of genes, both in normal cells and in the normal mouse brain, as well as correction of the transcription defects that you see in Friedreich's cells compared to wild-type cells. The good news is that these compounds don't appear to be toxic, at least on the treatments that we've done. And work at Repligen Corporation. But yes, there are widespread changes in gene expression, both in affected animals or cells and in normal cells.
Just to bring diabetes into the talk,
uh-huh.
You mentioned that 20% of patients with Friedreich's ataxia has diabetes. So now that there are standard protocols to generate beta cells, insulin-producing cells from embryonic stem cells, it looks to me this is a wonderful idea also. I mean, for example, of doing IPS, generating insulin-producing cells, and using your compounds to see if you have neurons and beta cells acting similarly.
Yes, sure. We have not done that, but of course.
I think it's a really nice system that you showed. You get the continued expansion when you make iPS cells from the ataxia patients. Do you think this is a property based on the rapid proliferation of the embryonic stem cells? And so you could invoke a model whereby, homologous recombination was involved, mm-hmm. and so you get a more dramatic expansion when the cells are proliferating more rapidly, rather than in the fibroblasts where they may be more quiescent.
But we have lymphoblastoid cell lines that divide more rapidly than the iPS cells, and you don't see the expansion there. There's something unique about going from a differentiated cell to a pluripotent cell that causes this expansion. Our idea now is that, as in Huntington's, this mismatch repair system that recognizes the GAA repeats in some unusual DNA structure and tries to repair them actually promotes an expansion.